Hello and welcome to the Foreign Desk Explainer on Monocle 24. I'm Steve Bloomfield. In this episode, Monocle's features editor Chris Lord asks, who really rules in Iran?
Iran heads to the polls this week for an election that's been billed as a bellwether for which way the country will go. Is Iran's future as an oppressive pariah state, kept out in the cold with the hardliners' favourite, Saeed Ibrahim Raisi, or a cautious returnee to the international community under the centrist coalition of the incumbent Hassan Rouhani? Yet there's another, perhaps bigger question at stake this week. Who really rules Iran? And how much actual power does the ballot paper have? Since Iran's deal with the West, reining in its nuclear programme in exchange for sanctions relief, the nation hasn't opened up as was predicted. Similarly, the average Iranian has yet to see any of the economic uptick promised as sanctions lift. The reasons, in part, come down to who really rules in the Islamic Republic. It is a bewildering hybrid system of presidential democracy, hardline theocracy, and crony capitalism. And Iran is presided over by an all-powerful Ayatollah, whose blessing any politician with ambitions must seek. It begins in 1979.
For Khomeini, the flight from Paris to Tehran marked the end of 15 years in exile. For the people of Iran, the arrival of his jetliner signaled the beginning of even more radical social and political changes than have already taken place.
1979 was the year that Iran, under the spiritual direction of exiled cleric Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, ousted its Western-backed monarch Shah Mohammad Reza Pahlavi. In contrast to the Pahlavi era, Iranians would now be free to elect their policymakers. There would be political parties and a popular vote. There was even a referendum on the name of the new Islamic Republic system. Yet the revolution was fundamentally a spiritual revolution. In its aftermath, Khomeini sat at the apex of the pyramid of power, above the president, a safeguard who could ensure that democracy never undermined the revolutionary and Islamic character of the republic. Iranians who decry the authoritarianism that's gripped the country since 1979 say that the Shah's oppressive rule was simply dressed up in a different way, with a black turban rather than the gold brocade. As supreme leader, Khomeini had the final say on the judiciary and executive branches of government. And any attempts at foreign policy would be filtered through his uncompromising antipathy to America and Israel. When Khomeini died in 1989, Ali Khamenei, a former president, took his place as supreme leader.
Our enemies explicitly say that the goal of economic pressure is political. Their goal is to turn the Iranian people against the Islamic regime.
Those chants of death to America sound as impassioned as they did in Khomeini's day. But there's a subtle difference behind the scenes. Khamenei is not as charismatic as his predecessor, but he did authorise negotiations with the West for sanction relief. Also, unlike Khomeini's era, the clergy class have seen some of their power to sway popular opinion wane. Instead, over the last 30 years, Khomeini's most fanatical supporters have been empowered. The Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, or the IRGC, are a paramilitary of zealots, many of whom were veterans of the Iran-Iraq War, and its own defence force that pledges absolute allegiance to the word of the revolution.
After the war, they entered the economy at the behest of then-President Akbar Hashemi Rafsanjani, who died this year in January, and Supreme Leader Khamenei. And they've been entrenched in the economy ever since, attempting to rebuild Iran and then growing their financial empire day by day.
Behnam Ben Taleblu is a senior analyst at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, a policy think tank in Washington, D.C.
Their military power, they have about 125,000 men-at-arms. They have basically a parallel military institution set up. Iran's, some of its most threatening portfolios are not overseen by the Artesh, or the conventional military. They're overseen by the Guard Corps. For instance, the Guard Corps has its own air wing called the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps Aerospace Force. This is the force that oversees Iran's ballistic missiles. And that's a force that the former director of national intelligence has called the largest arsenal of ballistic missiles in the Middle East. It's not without reason that we've had certain sanctions against Iran, and it's not without reason that Iran conforms to a certain, unfortunately, revolutionary pattern of state behavior. One of the reasons is the ideology, the other is the growing power and influence of this key player, the Guard Corps.
Bentelablu says that the things that keep Iran isolated and under sanctions, state-sponsored terror, the nuclear portfolio and ballistic missiles, are under the purview of the IRGC and not the president. No president has yet been able to rein in the growing power of the Revolutionary Guard. As some of Iran's nuclear sanctions lift, it's unearthed endemic problems that keep the economy mired in corruption, the crony capitalism, the nepotism and quasi-privatisation. For cynics of the nuclear deal, the feeling is that it most benefits those people and industries, particularly the oil sector, that are in the hands of IRGC zealots. Since 1989, every Iranian president has served two terms, and everyone has had a falling out with the supreme leader in that second term. It usually happens after they've tried to corral a little more power for themselves and their political ambitions. Does that stand for Hassan Rouhani? Well, analysts say that the democratic process is really for show. They're just to give legitimacy to the undemocratic Islamic Republic and a selection rather than an election process with Khamenei at the apex. So how cynical should Iranians be about this week's vote? Here's Behnam Bentelablu again.
The Iranian people still feel the desire to make their own voices heard. And so there's a fair amount of participation in these elections. And I think they're cognizant that they don't necessarily matter or aren't able to alter the fundamentals of the Islamic Republic. But they want to make sure that they can at least signal their discontent with the status quo by voting for the least hardline candidate. But I've long said one of the greatest tragedies of modern Iran, in fact, this current generation in Iran, is that they've always been forced to choose from bad and worse. That's an option that the Iranian election now, the one coming up on the 19th, really poses for them, between bad and worse.
That was the Foreign Desk Explainer. My thanks to Chris Lord. Tune in this Saturday for the full 30-minute edition of the Foreign Desk. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.